Well, as the Grateful Dead put it, trouble ahead, trouble behind. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Hope you had a nice weekend. My thanks to Becky for filling in on Friday. Now, I had to do some driving the past few days, and I saw lots and lots of old trains and tracks and stations. They were just beautiful. And I thought about today's program, because the genesis of this program came about because we were sitting around the office a while back, and we were talking about the future of the rail system in our region, and we realized we were talking about these exact same things decades ago. And we thought, what happened? There were all these grand visions and proposals, but really, when you think about it, how much has actually changed? And we mean for the LIRR, as well as the New Haven Line and Shoreline East. And nowadays, at least in Connecticut, we're hearing about another proposal. I don't know if you heard about it. It's called the 30-30-30 plan. It's 30 minutes on the train to get from Hartford to New Haven, 30 minutes from New Haven to Stamford, and then 30 minutes from Stamford into Grand Central. It sounds nice, doesn't it? But is it in any way practical? I mean, who's going to pay for this? And if somehow they do find the money, how quickly is it going to happen? Is it going to happen in our lifetimes? These are the questions. We'll spend the next hour talking about this. But first, let's get some background on the rail system. Tom Meehan is the chair of the New York chapter of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society. Hi, Tom. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Ron.
We appreciate your time. Tom, we need to know about the LIRR and the Metro North New Haven lines. When did they start? What are their origins?
Well, the New Haven line goes back to the 1840s, and the Long Island Railroad goes back to the 1840s. The Long Island Railroad is a consolidation of a lot of local lines. They didn't actually reach Manhattan until 1910, when they constructed the tunnel under the East River. The New Haven got into New York City about 1849. By using the New York and Harlem Railroad in the Bronx, a connection. And they started operating into what eventually became Grand Central.
Now, I know the lines have changed, obviously, somewhat, but fundamentally, yeah. Do you see any vast differences between then and now?
Fundamentally, there's not a lot of differences, but if you go back to the 1950s and the 60s, there's been a lot of new equipment. It's all air-conditioned. It's much more reliable, and there's a lot more service. In the last 50 years, the ridership on the New Haven line has quadrupled. So, obviously, they're doing something right.
When you look at, and I know you're a historian, and you study what other countries are doing, too, when you look at what they're doing, and you see what happens in Europe on some of the beautiful railroads and the lines I've been on over there, and then you look at something like the Japanese bullet train, do you look at it and say, why isn't that happening here?
Well, there's a fundamental difference. I don't know if you'd call it a problem, but there's a fundamental difference between Europe, Asia, and the United States, and that is the issue of public funding. And one difference in Europe and Japan in domestic travel, the airlines are not, they don't have the same role as they have in the United States because the distances are much smaller. But and most of these systems, not entirely, but in a large measure, they use public funds. And there's just no political consensus in this country for investing a lot of public money in railroad passenger service.
So over there, the distances are shorter, so it makes sense simply to hop a train. You don't need to get to the airport and hop on a plane. Just geography dictates what's going on there. Tom, is the rail system in our area going to change, or should we simply accept that it is what it is and, you know what, get used to it?
Well, I think the 30 minutes from New Haven to New York City, that doesn't sound feasible to me, not for many, many years, because It's technically feasible, but it would require a tremendous amount of money, just a tremendous amount. But the thing with the new, especially the New Haven line, is they have new cars coming online that are going to be more reliable. They're going to be fairly comfortable to ride in. And one of the big developments that's coming up is, I think in 3 or 4 years, the Long Island Railroad is going to start operating into Grand Central Terminal, and the New Haven line is going to start operating into Penn Station. And so this will give a lot more travel options to people. But I think that, you know, for the person who goes down to the station in the morning and gets on the train and rides into the city, no, I don't see it changing much.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into Grand Central and Penn Station. No more of that riding the line into Grand Central and then doing the mad dash over to Penn Station. I mean, I'm looking forward to that. Tom, we only had limited time with you today. I hope you come back with us in the future. I'd love to have a long discussion with you, if that's all right with you. Tom Meehan is the chair of the New York chapter of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society. Thank you again, Tom.
You're very welcome, Ron.
Alfonso Castillo is going to join us now for a few moments. Alfonso has been with us a few times over the past few months. He covers transportation for Newsday, and it's always great to have him on the show. Thanks, Alfonso. We appreciate your time as always.
Hi, Ron. Thank you for having me.
When you look at the Long Island, you've been chasing the Long Island Railroad story for quite some time now. When you look at it, do you say, you know what? The big changes aren't going to come. Let's accept it for what it is, and let's just fix it and make it as good as it can be.
I think some changes are on the way. I mean, I can't remember a time, and I don't think there's been a time since really the formative days of the Long Island Railroad, which turns 185 years old, I think this month, that there's been so much building going on. Some of it is already online, some of it is just a few years away, and some stuff is a little further out. But when you talk about a third track on the main line in Nassau County, a second track between Farmingdale and Ronkonkoma that was completed last year, the East Side Access Project, there's some big capacity improvements coming to Jamaica. There are new yards being built all over the place. There's new trains coming later this year. There's all kinds of plans to renovate Penn Station. In its totality, this is a lot of work, and it does change the railroad quite a bit. And in the end of the day, I think that the biggest issue in terms of a real kind of transformational change is just the layout of the railroad. For all these improvements, you're still talking about essentially the same design that was in place close to 200 years ago, when nobody could have expected that the Long Island Railroad would be moving the volume of people that it does now, because there weren't that many people on Long Island.
Mm.
So for all these improvements, I think they do make a difference. I think there are limits to how much you can increase capacity, although I do think they are doing a lot. And I do think it's making a difference. And even looking from now to a year ago, there are some indications that things are getting a little bit better.
It's like when they designed some of the roads around here, for instance, the Merritt Parkway. I mean, why would more than a few hundred people ever be on the Merritt Parkway at the same time when they designed it? I mean, who would think about designing it for the future? Alfonso, what would be the top 3 or 5 changes on your wish list, things that you would like to see done over the next 5 years, 10 years or so to really propel us into the future?
Well, what I want does make a difference. what commuters want, I think, are the big issue. And I think, by and large, what they want in some form or another aren't happening. I think new trains are a big thing. You know, it's the one thing that riders interface with every day is, you know, the train that they're on. And very often these are trains that are sometimes 40 years old. You know, they look it. They're in rough shape. The Long Island Railroad's newest trains are close to 20 years old now, and that's most of the fleet. Some go back to the 80s. And I think when on top of everything else, you know, delays or issues at your station or what have you, you get on a train and the train is in really rough shape, That can be kind of, you know, insult to injury.
Mm.
So I think it would go a long way to start rolling out these, you know, brand new trains. You got that new train smell inside. They're coming, you know. Theoretically, they should start to be coming next month. That was the date that the railroad's been throwing out there. You can start seeing these trains in May. And many more, a couple hundred, I think, are going to be on the way over the next couple of years. So that's a biggie. And then the third track is something that has been debated for decades, you know. And I've been covering this beat now for going on 11 years. And when I started on the beat, it was kind of a dirty word. You know, you didn't ask about the third track because it was such a sort of sensitive topic. There was a lot of you know, the third track was sort of the political third rail, right?
Mm.
Because the idea was that it would require building on people's properties and kicking them out of their home. And all these years later, they found a way to do it with really very little or none of those issues. And it's happening. I mean, today they shut down one crossing to start work there. So this is a project that is very much underway and could significantly increase the capacity through the biggest bottleneck on the railroad's main line. You know, when you've got just two tracks on the busiest stretch of the busiest commuter railroad in North America during rush hour, one little thing goes wrong, and it's this domino effect that could just, you know, devastate the whole system. So adding a third track there that will let them kind of work around problems is it's huge. You know, it's potentially transformational.
Alfonso, we're just out of time. As always,
I
appreciate
you
your time. Come back soon. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Alfonso Castillo, transportation reporter for Newsday. It's the full story on WSHU. A short break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and we're talking about the future of the railroads in our region. We're going to hear from Mitch Pally, a former Suffolk County representative on the board of the MTA, and we spoke with Mitch earlier today. Mitch, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you for inviting me.
Just some quick background. How long did you serve on the board of the MTA?
14 years.
14 years, so you've seen it all.
I've seen a variety of things. I'm not sure I've seen it all, but I've seen a variety of things over that period of time, yes.
Well, how did it work? Were you concentrating on the current issues, putting out fires, so to speak, or was there long-range planning mixed in? And when I say long-range, I mean 10 to 20 years out.
Yeah. There's a little of both. I mean, obviously, you know, from a board perspective, you only get involved on policy decisions, and that's how the MTA board is set up. Management, you know, the day-to-day operations of the railroad or all the railroads are conducted by management itself. So you only get involved in the larger scale issues, but long-range planning, you know, was part of that as both railroads, you know, both commuter railroads, Long Island Railroad and Metro North, put out 20-year needs analysis of what they believe their goals are going to be in 20 years, what their needs are going to be, what the costs are going to be of that, and then leave it to the policymakers and the stakeholders to determine, okay, from that list, you know, what is most appropriate and what can be paid for in that regard. So, but in addition, you obviously, you know, in any system where you're transporting 90 million people, which is what Long Island Railroad transports basically, and almost 90 million, which is what Metro North, you know, when you have hundreds of trains every day, you're always going to have issues that come up, maintenance issues, management issues that, you know, the board tries very hard to try to find a solution for from a financing standpoint. So, you know, it's a combination of both in that regard.
All right, so you mentioned 20 years, possibly in terms of long-range planning. So if we look down the road now and say 2039, 2040, what do you envision?
Well, on Long Island, obviously one of the focal points is electrification of the lines that are not now electrified. Long Island Railroad has both a combination of electric train service and non-electric or diesel train service. And the diesel train service, of course, is less reliable and less convenient than the electrified train area. So one of the goals of the railroad is obviously to electrify those areas which are not yet done. In addition, obviously, you know, you're looking to expand the operations because from a railroad, Long Island Railroad perspective, pretty soon we're going to be able to go into both Penn Station, where we can go now, and into Grand Central. And in Metro North's case, it's the exact opposite. They now go into Grand Central, and, you know, one of the plans for them in the next 20 years is for them to be able to go both to Grand Central and to Penn Station. So that's not as simple as it sounds. There are a lot of technical issues that have to be resolved, engineering issues, expansion issues. In Metro North's case, agreements with Amtrak, because Amtrak owns many of the tracks that that go, you know, the trains go over. And in Long Island, that means building East Side Access, the new terminal. It means building a second track and a third track to expand the capacity. So those have been the focal points of the 20-year needs analysis in both cases.
Mitch, what brought the program up was that a group of us were sitting around talking the other week. We all had the same memories. We had these discussions about transportation, you know, 3 or 4 decades ago. And to be honest, it was a little dispiriting. So with that in mind, we said, we keep hearing about how the system is going to change. What if we simply said, you know what? It is what it is. Just make it run better. Keep it clean. Keep it safe. Give me a space to park my car. Make sure it's there when I get back. And that's okay.
And that's basically what you're going to have. Even after 20 years, you know, a long period of the system changing, those are the goals that are there. You know, as I've said before on many occasions, to eliminate the safety issues on Long Island, you'd have to eliminate 280 at-grade crossings. We neither have the time, nor the money, nor the political will to do all of that. And so as a result of that, that results in limited service in certain areas. It results in reduced speeds. And that's part of the context. That is never going to be eliminated. Metro North has many of the same technological advances, but also you have challenges in many areas where the railroad already exists. It's not as if you're putting down a new railroad and starting from scratch. In many cases, you are making changes to a system that had been in existence over 100 years in both cases.
Mm.
So those are the goals that you have to find. You're always going to have maintenance issues. You're always going to have technical issues that crop up. But being able to provide a safe and efficient system with the adequate parking, one of the issues is, you know, transit-oriented development. The more people who live within walking distance is going to be able to eliminate the need for a parking space because of the increased usage of the railroad, you almost need a parking garage at every local stop, and the localities have not been thrilled with wanting to do that. And as a result of that, you can't find the land to do as much at-grade parking as you might want to find. So you have to work into the political, technical, and financial limitations that you are faced with. But having said that, the system clearly can be safer, more efficient, but it's never going to be what people presume it's ever going to be in that context.
Mitch, one last question, if I can. How does global warming fit into all of this? We've had a number of scientists and experts on this program, and they've said, look, the shoreline, the coastline, it's not going to be what it is now. 10, 20 years down the road, a lot of those ports that we rely on and possibly the rail lines, the land is simply not going to be there. So how does the long-range planning fit into that?
Well, you have to. I mean, and in many cases, especially in the Metro North case, you know, the train runs along the shoreline because that's how it was designed 100 years ago when the train tracks were put down. You know, moving that inland is almost impossible to do. You cannot find the land, nor anyone has the political will to take other people's property to do that. So, what you're going to have to do is shore up to the extent you can and protect the rail that is already there along the shoreline to the extent you need to do so, that will be done. But what climate change and, you know, global warming also does is it encourages more people to want to take the train. And, you know, I don't think you've seen yet, you know, Long Island, the railroad just broke a new record last year, and I don't see that stopping. as more and more people want to live near the train stations, as more and more people don't want to drive because of, you know, global warming and carbon emissions, you're going to see more and more people want to take the train. What that's going to require is more service, expansion, more parking, you know, in those areas where that's necessary. And those are going to be very, very significant political and financial challenges.
Yeah, financially, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars, right?
Everything costs at least $1 billion. You know, it's amazing how that works in the railroad industry. But it costs a lot of money. And that's, you know, in many cases, that's without land acquisition. When you add land acquisition, if you want to do something more than that, it's even going to cost you more money in that regard. So, you know, the political will to finance all of that and the subsidies necessary from the general population to the railroads is going to be increasingly an issue as we move forward. As you can see, you know, the MTA board just raised fares on Metro North and Long Island Railroad and the subway system. Is that going to be able to continue ad infinitum? I don't believe so. But what that's going to do is require additional subsidies from the general population to make that sustainable.
Mitch Pally is a former Suffolk County representative on the board of the MTA. He did it for 14 years. Mitch, we always appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
Anytime. Thank you.
And we're back live now, and we're going to speak with Randy Glucksman. Randy is the chair of the Metro North Railroad Commuter Council and also their representative on the MTA board. Randy, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you.
How would you make the system, the railroad system, safer and more efficient in our region?
Well, we have the PTC, which is currently being installed all over the system. And just, you know, it isn't the only thing that's out there. We have pretty safe signaling and other systems that are already in place. And I never want for our customers to believe that the system is not safe because it doesn't have PTC. Consider PTC as an overlay of the existing system, which is perfectly safe.
How would you...
It provides an extra level of protection.
How would you rate the railroads in our region nowadays?
They're in very good shape and they're getting better. With more money, they can do more things.
I know you heard part of the conversation that I had with Mitch a short time ago, it's kind of like a chicken and egg thing, right? I mean, here it is. We have global warming, and so a lot of people are saying, look, let's take public transportation. Let's take the trains. Let's get off the roads. It's a headache being on the Long Island Expressway on I-95, and that means more passengers for Metro North, more passengers for the LIRR.
This is true. This is absolutely true.
So what do they need to accommodate all these passengers for the future? I mean, has it just come down to money at this point?
Well, yeah, more money, more cars. The schedules are pretty tight as they are now. I mean, in certain places, you really can't add many more trains, but there are projects online with the Eastside Access Project scheduled to open at the end of 2022. A lot of commuters or customers who are generally going to Penn Station, New York, and having to jump on subways or buses to go to the east side, now we'll be able to take a train directly into a Grand Central Terminal.
I am so looking forward to that. I think that's fantastic.
And I think you're up in Connecticut, so in your way, the board approved the project to design the Penn Access study, which would have a number of New Haven Line trains also go into Penn Station over the Hellgate Line, where Amtrak is right now only the only rail provider operating these trains. But that's not scheduled to come on to like a year or so after the Side Access opens.
Randy, when you look around the world and you see some of the systems in other countries, I mean the good ones, there are some bad ones, obviously. What do you think when you see them? Do you ever sit there and go, man, if we could just do that around here?
Well, the United States of America had an outstanding rail system in the 50s, and then it started to decline because of the air traffic boom. And, of course, there were a lot of interferences with the oil lobby and the automobile lobby that helped to kill some of the rail lines. And in the other countries, there wasn't a competition like that. The railroads were there, and then they took steps. The government jumped in and took over and you know, ran the things and did all the expansion of services that they need to do.
And in that same vein, when we're talking about global warming and climate change and the push now for more public transportation, good public transportation, is there a potential for another golden age for railroads in the future?
I would hope so. I mean, the younger generation, they are the ones who like to live near places where there is good public transportation. Many of them, I'm told, do not own vehicles. And, of course, in transit-oriented development, there are projects on all the railroads going on now where the localities are. They're very involved and invested. And the builders are there, too, to make these stations accessible for the commuters.
I think you're absolutely right with what you said. I keep hearing and seeing more and more reports about the younger generation simply moving to the downtown areas and saying, you know what, I'm not going to own a car. If I need to get somewhere by automobile every now and then, I'll take Uber, I'll take Lyft, I'll take a cab, but otherwise put me close to the train station.
True.
So what would you like to see done in the very near future, in the next 5 years, 10 years? I mean, concrete proposals, actions that need to be taken right away to really improve the rail system, both on Long Island and in Connecticut.
I don't really have a wish list. I mean, for local projects I'd like to see got done in the metropolitan area, it's very important that we get the new tunnels between New Jersey and New York that are used by Amtrak and New Jersey Transit. I've been to several presentations about that project, which is called Gateway. 25% of the nation's GDP is affected by being able to move, have good mobility between the Northeast and Washington, D.C. In New York, we have, be nice to have the number 7 line extended to Secaucus, New Jersey. That would take a lot of pressure off of buses going into the Lincoln Tunnel and so on. That's a great project. It was supported years ago, proposed by former Mayor Bloomberg, but there's been no action on this lately.
I remember about the tunnel between New York and New Jersey, and wasn't that shut down during the Christie administration?
Well, this was the ARC project. I served with some other number of other volunteers on a project that it was called Access to the Region's Core. And at the end of the project, we were given 3 choices. One, and they named them Plan P, just for new tunnels from New Jersey that would dead end in New York, right Penn Station area. It was a Plan S, which extended the tracks to Sunnyside Yard in Queens to get rid of the trains. And the Plan G is the one that we all approved, which would have extended the service eastbound on the 34th Street area and made a left turn and gone up into Grand Central. And you would have been able to provide through service from New Jersey all the way with a different routing up to Connecticut or upstate New York. I mean, the possibilities were endless. But back when this happened in the late 90s, the MTA pulled out of it, and it became strictly a New Jersey project. And then it morphed into something else. And then the Governor Christie canceled and ultimately had to return many millions of dollars to the federal government.
It sounds like something in terms of infrastructure and taking the pressure off the roads that would have been an amazing project for our region. Do you think that people understand? I mean, obviously commuters get it because 90 million people are going in and out of the city every day, obviously. But do you think that the average person who's listening to this realizes how important the rail lines are to this region in terms of us getting around to the economy?
I would hope so. I mean, I know from years ago, people that were friends of ours, and many of them did take the public transportation, but others felt that they wanted to drive their own privately owned cars because they were provided with a parking space by their employer, and they drove into the city every day. And I just don't know how they did it. I don't know how people do it today.
And look, with congestion pricing coming up soon, right? That may change.
Yes.
That may change some people's habits in terms of driving.
I think it will.
Randy Glucksman has been with us. He is the chair of the Metro North Railroad Commuter Council and is their representative on the MTA board. Randy, we thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Same here. Thank you for your time. Coming up in our last segment, we're going to be talking pretty much about the Metro North New Haven line. And with us will be Jim Cameron, who is the founder of the Connecticut Commuter Action Group. Jim has been with us a number of times. Some people say he's like the transportation guru in this area. He's been watching it and dealing with it for years. And Jim Gilday is also going to be with us. Jim is the chairman of the Connecticut Commuter Rail Council, so we'll be getting their thoughts about what should be done to improve the system. And, you know, we're looking at it for 5 to 10 to 20 years from now. If you would like to join in the conversation, we'd like to get your comments. You could email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. You can find us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU, or you can call us 833-CALL-TFS. That comes out to 833-225-5837. One last break, and we'll be right back. It's the Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're talking about the future of transportation in our region, specifically the trains. I want to take, though, 20 seconds to tell you about Wednesday's show, because we'd like to know what you think. It's no secret that our region needs money. We're talking about transportation. You're hearing about the billions that are going to be needed to fix up the rail lines. We also hear about balancing the budget. And to do that, there are proposals now in Connecticut for more casinos, New York too, sports betting, legalizing pot. That way the state can get the tax dollars from the sales. And how about upping the tax on big gulps and sugary drinks? The state wants your money. Now, does this bother you? First of all, nobody likes to be taxed. But the fact that a few years ago we were told that certain activities, including the ones that I just mentioned, were considered morally questionable. And now it looks like, as Pete Townsend once wrote, the morals that they worship will be gone. That's going to be the basis of our program on Wednesday. What have we become? How did we get here? And what's next? And what are we going to look like in a few years from now? If you have any thoughts on the subject, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us, tfs@wshu.org. Let's continue with that discussion on the future of railroads in our region. We're going to bring in two more guests who are semi-regulars on The Full Story. We're always pleased when they can give us their time. Jim Cameron is the founder of the Connecticut Commuter Action Group, and Jim Gilday is the chairman of the Connecticut Commuter Rail Council. Jims, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ron.
How are you? Jim Cameron, I know you were trying to listen to the program. I didn't know if you heard a lot of it. Basically, the gist of this is the future of the rail systems in our region. Are they what they are? Can we expect any big changes over the next 10, 20 years? Or should we simply say, you know what, let's fix what we have and move on?
Well, clearly the priority is to make sure that what we have is still operating and trains are not derailing. Service is not degrading, and before we can even, you know, start looking at the future, we've got to fix what we have. And we can't even fix what we have without more funding. So, you know, anything that we have aspirationally in terms of adding more service, increasing the frequency of the trains, you know, is all dependent upon money. And until we find those revenue streams, we're not going to be able to deal with that. So I am sure that the DOT, even though they are dealing with a diminished workforce and a lot of folks that are getting very close to retirement in the next few years, they have a small army of people that are making those long-range plans because they're necessary to get whatever kind of federal money we might be able to acquire down the road.
Jim Gilday, you are somewhat responsible for today's program because the last time you were in the studio with Jim Cameron, at the end of it, we were talking about the 30-30-30 plan, and you simply said, look, how about just getting the trains to be on time, make sure there's a space for my car, make sure the car is going to be there when I get back, and that'll make me happy.
You know, Ron, I think that would still be the mantra if you talk to the average commuter. I think the average commuter, again, just wants to sit in rail cars that are clean, that are efficient. I think they want to sit in trains that get them to pick pick them up on time and get them to work on time. And I know we spend a lot of time talking about the main line, and rightfully so. I mean, that really is the economic driver of the line. But there's an awful lot of branches, whether it be the Shoreline East, whether it be the New Canaan line, whether it be the Waterbury branch, I mean, whether it be the Danbury branch. Those folks are not satisfied. The level of service to the branches is poor. It continues to be poor. So I'm hard-pressed to think that we are going to focus a whole lot of time and energy on the 30-30-30 when we can't get folks from places like Danbury or places like Waterbury to the main line effectively and efficiently. And again, just quickly, today, case in point, Waterbury commuters found out that the new timetables that Metro North put out now means that they have to leave work 30 minutes earlier to catch the departing train, or stay 2 hours and 59 minutes later to get the next train. So I really think we have a tremendous amount of work to get service right as it currently exists today.
Speaking of new timetables, Jim Cameron, you have a new article that you wrote just about that, right?
Yeah, it's coming out next week, and it tries to explain to puzzled commuters why the trains now are running slower than ever before when we keep talking about this aspirational 30-30-30 plan of running 30 minutes from Stamford to Grand Central, which is now like 54 minutes, and 30 minutes from Stamford to New Haven, which is now like 56 minutes. But the new timetable shows trains running 1 to 10 minutes longer. In addition to what Jim just mentioned, which is just a mind-boggling decision to change the rush hour trains without really notifying the passengers or getting input from the commuter council. Why are the trains running slower? Because there is so much work that still needs to be done to maintain the tracks, the signal system, the right-of-way, as it's called. And it's, you know, it's hard when you're running a four-track railroad pretty much at capacity to take out a track to do maintenance work, maybe even two tracks in some places. You know, I keep saying it's like trying to change the fan belt on a running automobile. You know, you can't provide the service if you don't have the capacity that you're used to. Those repairs are necessary, and they're not just going to happen in this construction season over the summer. But we're looking at several years more of these kind of delays.
And how many more years are we talking? 1, 2, 5, 10?
Well, if you ask Metro North, they're very reluctant to put a number to it. But the folks that I know and I've talked to have told me off the record, it's probably more like 4 or 5 years. I mean, when Joe Giulietti, the current commissioner of the DOT, who I was hoping was going to be on your show today.
So were we.
I'm sure you were as well. When he was at Metro North, I think 2 years ago, he said it would be another 5 years. And that was 2 years ago, so 3 more years. But I think that number has not improved over this period of time since he came from Metro North to the commissionership at the Department of Transportation. So maybe they're over-promising and they can under-promise and over-deliver. Maybe it won't be 5 years, but it sure ain't going to be 1 year. The trains are now operating at a slower timetable because the on-time performance in the past year has been abysmal. They couldn't operate the trains at the timetable they'd hoped. So at least they'll be back to a better, on paper at least, on-time performance. And what that means to the commuter is that your 7:13 train is probably going to be there every day at 7:13 instead of 7:18 as it used to be. So the timetable will be more reliable. And you know what? When commuters complain to me, oh, my train was 5 minutes late, my train was 10 minutes late, I go, hey, you got home safely, right? You're having dinner with your family, and you're not, in a derailment, or you're not dead next to the track because the railroad put on-time performance ahead of safety. And if it learned nothing from those accidents in Fairfield and Espoit and Dival, it learned that safety has got to be the top priority. So suck it up, guys. You give the railroad their due, let them fix things, and in the long run, the service will improve.
It's like when I'm on a plane and there's a ton of turbulence, but as soon as we hit the runway, I say to myself, you know, that was a good flight. It's you got home safe, right? I mean, it's okay. Jim Gill Day, what needs to be done right away? I mean, what would you like to see done right away to make life improved for you and members of the Rail Council and all the commuters in Connecticut?
Well, if you asked me that question 2 days ago, I would have had a different answer perhaps than what I'm going to tell you today. So today, and I certainly hear and agree with Mr. Cameron for certain about the safety aspect of it, but to tell commuters today, on the day of their train, that they have to leave their job 30 minutes earlier to catch a train or they have to wait 3 hours is poor. I mean, to have had no level of discussion or discourse about the schedule change other than the every two-hour, hey, new timetables are coming, which they advertise as being minor in a few minutes. It's certainly 30 minutes isn't minor. So I would say first and foremost, I think they have to look at the new timetable today and the impact that had. Separate from that, if you know, in my opinion, and I do speak probably more from a branch rider perspective, is I really think they need to expedite the condition of the coaches, the condition of the day-to-day ride, and they need to complete the overhaul of the diesels so that there's some level of mechanical reliability alongst the branches, and there's enough cars, diesels, to adequately move everybody along the various branches for certain. I would tell you that would be one of my key changes.
Jim Cameron, I'm sorry, same question.
Well, I think Jim's, you know, right on. I mean, he's a daily commuter on the Waterbury branch, and the Waterbury branches are the, you know, as I've always said, the Rodney Dangerfield of the railroad. They don't get no respect. There are constant breakdowns. The locomotives don't work. The trains are late. The connections aren't made if you're trying to make one. You know, and it's not that the people from Metro North and the DOT are stupid or evil or out to just aggravate us. I think they're doing the best they can given the situation and the equipment that they have. Maybe they could have planned for the locomotive repairs a bit better. I think they deserve points for better communication when things go wrong. But we're trying to get cars off of the road. We're trying to encourage people to take mass transit. And offering this kind of service is not the way to do it.
We have an email from David, and he writes, "We cannot have this conversation without acknowledging the massively inflated capital construction costs of the MTA, which could devour all new revenues raised by construction as well as our high operating costs, in part due to outdated fare collection processes and reliance on multiple conductors on trains. We also need to confront the fact that the MTA board cannot provide appropriate oversight and does not adequately represent riders in terms of who board members are. And lastly, and this is a good question, why does this conversation on the future of rail in our region only feature the voices of white middle-aged men? And I'm one of them. That is not reflective of the ridership or the future riders of the system. David, I thank you for your email. And you know what? From my perspective, you're absolutely right. And in the future, when we do programs on transportation and the rails, I think we'll have more diversity in terms of our voices. But Jim Cameron, Jim Gilday.
Great, I've become middle-aged.
Yeah, there you go. I was just speaking for me. So what do you gentlemen think of David's email and his thoughts? Jim Gilday, can I start with you, please?
So for certain, I'm an everyday commuter, so I'll be the first to say that I pay, you know, when I pay my pass, it does frustrate me just as much as it frustrates the next person that people don't pay their fares. I'm not going to pretend to be an engineering expert, but it is inconceivable to me that in 2000, soon to be 2020, that we cannot find a better way to ensure fares are collected. So I would agree with David for certain on that there's got to be a better way to collect fares. I will grudgingly concede that I've become middle-aged.
Jim Cameron.
Well, I think he's hit a number of good issues. Let me tick off a couple of them. One, yes, construction costs by the MTA are astronomically high compared to other countries around the world. I mean, the whole project that they're doing now for what's called East Side Access, this just gargantuan tunneling project underneath Grand Central to allow Long Island Railroad trains to come into Grand Central. I mean, their inspector general at the MTA found that there was, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars being wasted with no-show jobs, et cetera. So, but this seems to be endemic to construction in New York City overall. I don't think corruption is unique to the MTA. So, yeah, it is very expensive, and it needs to be policed as well, too. I agree with Jim in terms of the uncollection of tickets, but I think David's the point was that having multiple conductors on a train to collect tickets seems to be an inefficient way of doing it. You know, I've written in the past about going to the honor system, where you have a ticket inspector come around and occasionally challenge you, and if you don't have a ticket, you get a $100 fine. I mean, that has worked in some transits. It works in Europe all the time, but people are honest over there. They use it on the San Diego trolley. It might be a way of doing it. Conductors are expensive. I think conductors make, I don't know, anywhere but $50,000 to $75,000 a year. And they're more than just ticket punchers. They are responsible for the operation of the train. The MTA board, the Metro North board, those people are appointed by the commissioners, I'm sorry, by the county commissioners in each of the counties in Westchester County. So if David has an issue with the lack of rider representation on that MTA board, I think he's got a point, but he has to take it up with his local county executive. Connecticut does not have appointees on the Metro North board. We only have, you know, Jim Gilday and the commuter council out there representing riders in Connecticut.
And in terms of talking about conductors and talking to a few of them in the past, obviously they also have an important job in terms of safety. If something is going wrong with one of the passengers, whether health or concerns or there's some type of disruption, the conductors are there to make sure that no one gets injured, no one gets sick.
Yeah, exactly. And they're the ones that open the doors. They're the ones that tell the engineer when it's safe to leave a station. They're the ones that communicate with passengers, hopefully, when something goes wrong and there's a delay. So they're more than just ticket punchers. They have, you know, I don't think analogizing their job to one of stewardesses where, you know, they're not a waitress in the sky. They're a safety expert who makes sure that the passengers can get on and off the plane safely. Now, they have an important role. And I think because they are the face of the railroad to most commuters, they take a lot of abuse, which should really be directed higher up in the chain of command.
Jim Gilday, final thoughts, and I'd like to wrap it up with this, because we'll, you know, over the next few months, obviously, we'll be doing more programs on global warming. Is enough being done in terms of planning for the future for the rail system in our region with the changing coastline and with the effects that it will have on transportation?
No, I mean, absolutely not. I certainly do not think that we do enough to take advantage of the benefits of mass transportation and getting people off the road and getting cars off the road. We do need to get serious and make the necessary investments to make mass transit a more viable option so that we could, yes, better take care of our environment and better reduce emissions and certainly protect the earth.
Jim Cameron, is there that public support? Because it will cost billions to do this.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, it's the fact that the railroad runs along Long Island Sound, and Long Island Sound's water level is rising. And in some places, it's, you know, the tracks are only maybe 5 feet above the sea level out there. And we're going to see some nor'easter come down in a full moon situation, and we're going to see water lapping against the tracks at some point. What are we going to do? Put a dike up the entire way? You know, if we're investing so much in the Northeast Corridor, which is not just for Metro North but also for Amtrak, you know, we got to make sure that we're planning for the effects of global warming on literally lapping at our doorstep.
Jim Cameron is the founder of Connecticut Commuter Action Group, and you can find a number of his articles online. For instance, ctmirror.org always has some op-ed pieces from Jim Cameron. And Jim Gilday is chairman of the Connecticut Commuter Rail Council. Jim Cameron, Jim Gilday, always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you, guys.
Same here. Thank you, guys.
And I'd also like to thank Mitch Pally, Randy Glucksman, Alfonso Castillo, and Tom Meehan, who joined us a little bit earlier in our program. That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers, Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part on this tax day of The Full Story.